This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Anatoly Karlin. We're going to be discussing the situation in Syria. Anatoly, great having you back on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back on your show as well.
So you've written a series of articles on the UNS Review about the conflict. Are you writing about this primarily from the Russian perspective?
I'm trying to write it from an objective / realistic perspective to the extent that's possible. I'm just not advocating really anything, but just saying the sorts of consequences that these events could have. So one of the big problems is that usage of chemical weapons hasn't been proven, and the evidence behind it is really dodgy.
So there's no evidence whatsoever of who did it. Some people are speculating the rebels did it. Some people are saying CIA or Mossad, but there's really no proof of any particular party.
The people are flinging out proof, but it's not clear that any of it is worth anything. And if you look at the specifics of that situation, there's been these three rebel pockets inside Damascus for years now, which have been occupied by jihadis. And Assad was just on the last few days of clearing out that last pocket.
So it would be very
strange to use gas precisely in that situation.
There's no incentive whatsoever. Assad was pretty much at the point. This war has been going on about 7 years, and he's very close to victory, so there's no incentive for him to use chemical weapons when he knows it would bring about a major backlash.
So yeah, and the problem is that there's a bunch of perverse incentives in play, because ever since Trump decided to strike Syria back in April 2017, the rebels, they've had this incentive to keep on doing this, or the intelligence services who want to organize the false flag, or whoever's organizing this. And the thing is that Trump has also committed himself to progressively harsher responses. So last time he launched 60 cruise missiles, this time it was 120 cruise missiles. According to the Duma Vine, actually, it was Trump and Bolton who wanted to launch more missiles. It was, like Stanges at this to say, it was Mad Dog Mattis who talked them down into a more measured response.
We did a show about the last Syrian missile strike about a year ago. I think it was April of last year. And nothing really came of the last strikes. Those seem to be, in a sense, almost purely symbolic. Do you see the same thing happening, or this could escalate into something far worse than what happened last year?
Today it seems that the moderates have won out, and this strike has also been symbolic and pre-cleared with the Russians. So twice more missiles than last time, but casualties seem to be very low, because most of the facilities which were hit were vacated ahead of time. According to the Duma Vine, Bolton in particular, being Bolton, was arguing for a much more substantial response. And the problem is that that if you keep on, how many missiles is going to be next time? If it's 120 now, will it have to be 240 next time, and then 480 in a geometric progression? You see these, there's some really nasty escalator dynamics involved in this.
So when Trump ran for president and when he first started out, he started out more as a foreign policy realist, but recently he's gone in a more neoconservative direction. Would you say, hiring John Bolton as national security advisor is probably like the peak neocon. He's like the ultimate neocon, so that shows Bolton influencing Trump or Trump embracing the neocon agenda.
Pompeo and Haley, he's bringing in all these swamp creatures, and I don't know if that reflects his two positions or not, but it was always obvious that there was also a strong Zionist component to Trump's foreign policy agenda, and it's quite possible that those of us who took his isolationist rhetoric back during the election campaign were sort of cucked by the Donald, you could say.
Yeah, definitely. Would you say it's more of an Israeli lobby agenda, a Saudi oil interest agenda, or a humanitarian interventionist agenda, or a combination of the three?
Well, I don't think there's anybody serious in the Trump agenda about the humanitarian aspect, except as cover. I mean, Kushner is very deep into with Saudi Arabia and with Israel, actually. And his daughter. It's well known that his daughter exercises a lot of influence on him. And all the people who were sort of in a more realistic or America First camp, like Tillerson and Flynn. Flynn was very anti-Iran, but better than these people. It seems to me pretty clear that we're going into this this direction where the U.S. foreign policy is done by these various Middle Eastern tribes, to a considerable extent anyway.
So you'd say it's a coalition of both the Israeli lobby and Saudi interests influencing our foreign policy?
Well, yeah, I would imagine so. The Saudis, the Israeli lobby is more of a ethnic influence lobby, whereas the Saudis, I think they just have a huge financial firepower, which they use to buy things up. So we know that back when Trump was visiting Saudi Arabia last year, there was the biggest weapons deal in history, something like more than $100 billion worth of weapons imports that they agreed upon.
Okay, so Brandon Adamson will be joining us later. I'll continue. So, Anatoly, you have this article titled Gloomy Predictions at the UNS Review. And these are not necessarily what's going to happen, but these are just kind of worst-case scenarios. And you talk about what would happen if Russia were to retaliate against the United States.
Yes, the article in question is the road to World War III. And as I wrote, the main thing that I wasn't predicting that this particular situation will spiral out of control, but the likelihood of this happening over time goes up because of the escalatory dynamics which I mentioned just a few minutes ago. And eventually it's possible that if Russian troops do get hit, and especially if it's a big enough attack that it's not something that the Kremlin could cover up, then there might be very strong domestic pressures to do something about it. Now, what could you do about it? Russia would prefer to avoid getting into confrontation over Israel, because over Syria, because its forces there, they are significant, but they're still very much overwhelmed by what CENTCOM has in the region, not to mention America's allies. Well, I mean, Russia has about 40 Pantsir systems, two S-400 complexes, a couple of submarines, and just a dozen fighters, air superiority fighters. And arranged against that, the U.S. has, well, just a single carrier has a few dozen F-18s, and Turkey has 200 F-15s, and so I mean, it's just something. If there's a conflict there, it's something that that Russia will lose. So if it's going to respond there somewhere to such an attack, it will have to be well, either Putin will have to hunker down and accept the political consequences. I mean, he's in a pretty good position to do so because he's got 80% approval ratings, but still, whether there'll be increased sanctions upon Russia, falling living standards, it's unclear if that would be sustainable in the long term. Or he could retaliate in other regions, such as the Persian Gulf, or the Ukraine, or even the Baltics, potentially.
So yeah, there's a lot of different scenarios. One scenario is the Russian military hitting U.S. Ships with missiles, or there's a U.S. military base in Turkey near the Syrian border, and possibly even the military bases in the Gulf states. Then you mentioned the scenarios of if Russia wants to intervene in the Ukraine or the Baltics. I don't really see that as likely to happen, because it would bring about a massive backlash from NATO and the United States, but these are just worst-case scenarios. Another issue is if Iran is dragged in, Iran could shut down the Strait of Hormuz, which could crash the global economy by shutting off the supply of oil.
I don't think that bombing U.S. bases in the Middle East would be a very clever response, because that would still put Russia in a state of war, or almost war, with the United States anyway. I mean, as I said, CENTCOM has a lot more military assets there. It's not going to be fighting in a sphere that favors it, basically. In contrast, if Russia helps Iran shut down the state of Hormuz, or in the Ukraine, or in the Baltics, it's actually, especially there, unlike in the Middle East, around Syria, Russia has the escalation dominance there. It's more powerful relative to the U.S. and NATO in those regions.
What is the likelihood of Israel getting dragged into a conflict with either Hezbollah or Iran?
In this situation, pretty probably very high, because if the U.S. does decide to reduce and eliminate Russian presence in Syria, then Israel, frankly, would have nothing to lose by joining in and also helping get rid of the Iranian influence in Syria, because this is something that that Israel isn't accepting. It's something that it's very much against, having Iranian troops in Syria.
So what would happen if Assad were removed from power? Is the Syrian civil war would escalate, and the rebels would regain strength, but you'd also see Hezbollah filling in the vacuum. So you're talking about, in that kind of scenario, Israel might intervene.
I don't know if Israel will intervene with ground forces. In fact, probably won't in Syria itself. However, there's a point that I want to make. It's that in the past a year and a half, ever since Syria started making advances on the conquering territory, it took back Palmyra, it took back Aleppo, carved out. It eliminated ISIS together with the Kurds. So that period of successes, it coincided with the appearance of the Shinar power. So before that, they could not make successful attacks because the Syrian other army, it's a pretty corrupt and demoralized force, and it's not really a force that can do combined arms operations very well. It can only defend at best. So if you remove the Shinar power from the equation, which is what we're talking about if there's a serious confrontation between the U.S. and Russia with Syria, because CENTCOM is much more powerful than what Russia has there, then not only will it be removed, but they'll probably see the imposition of a no-fly zone by the U.S. over Syria immediately afterwards. So yes, the rebels will, despite being pretty hammered now, I would expect them in this scenario to retake the initiative and to start rolling back the Syrian forces. And they'll be really, really demoralized now because they've been winning at last for the past year, and now you have this this reversal.
So you have this article, How Can Russia Hurt the USA? These are points that you already touched upon, but the key question is it worth it from a Russian perspective? The United States' retaliation would do serious damage, but it could potentially damage both countries. But are the implications of retaliating worth it? That's the key question.
Oh, okay. I mean, I just want to clarify that my article about how can Russia hurt the U.S., it's about economics, actually. Doesn't have anything to do with military affairs. It was actually written, I think, before the gas attack, or before the crisis around the gas attacks, at any rate. And it was in response to the U.S. Implementing more sanctions against Russia, so declaring some companies to be specifically designated nationals, which forbids the U.S. from doing business with them, freezes their U.S. assets, requires any American citizens to sell stocks with them. Now, because the United States, it's basically 20% of world GDP, it has a lot of influence over this sort of thing. So actually, U.S. sanctions, even if some Russian company doesn't do a lot of business with the U.S., that still cuts a lot of opportunities for it, because there's a European country, like imagine a European company, do they do business with that Russian company, or do they save themselves the U.S. market if the alternative is to be sanctioned by the U.S. for doing business with that Russian company? They choose the U.S., of course. Their shares collapsed once the companies which were sanctioned this way. And there's this impression that because the Russian economy seems very small and weak relative to the U.S., that the U.S. could implement sanctions at will and gradually grind it down. And there's this impression among some circles that Russia can't do anything in response to that, economically, I mean. And I just listed some ways in which it actually can sanction the U.S.
So I'm joined here with Brandon Adamson. Brandon, you wrote an article about this conflict. Your theme was whether there can be a broader anti-war coalition. Do you want to plug your article?
Yeah, I mean, I was basically writing about... I wrote an article called People Who Hate Each Other Against the War, which is basically trying to form a broader anti-war coalition it's become such a huge issue that it almost is like it's almost more important than so many other issues. Like, it would be great to set aside other things for a moment and just find people who agree to work to keep the U.S. out of these kinds of engagements. It almost seems like it's impossible. There's like no one to vote for.
Yeah, really. It's true. Well, it is true, because if you look at the coalition, the establishment, whether it's the Trump administration or the liberal establishment at CNN, is pretty much pro-interventionism, but On the anti-war side, you have a pretty wide diversity. You have Richard Spencer in the alt-right, but then you also have Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. So there's quite a spectrum opposing the war.
Yeah, and even the guys from the Young Turks, remember,
he
came out against it, and which I mentioned in my article, which is interesting because him and Alex Jones hate each other. Remember, they had that confrontation at the Republican convention, and they both came out against it. So it would be nice if people could set aside their egos for a minute. I think it would make a really strong statement if you could hold some kind of event where you would get all of these people that hate each other to have a rally against the war. It would send like, it'd say like, look, you know, even though like we don't even get along and we're willing to be on the same side to stop this kind of nonsense. Like, I think it would send a really strong message. I don't know that that it could really be possible. There are some precedents for it, but I just think it would be interesting. I think it's really the most important thing right now.
Yeah, I even remember during the Bush era, there was the left-wing anti-war movement, and then you had, back then it was people like Pat Buchanan and even Ron Paul, and libertarians in a sense, and...
Right, you had like Ron Paul and like Dennis Kucinich,
right.
Like both basically agreeing.
And there was some back then, someone like Pat Buchanan could talk to someone like Dennis Kucinich, but we've become a lot more polarized today than we were back then between the dissident left and dissident right.
Yeah, I think so too, but I also think that it could, the anti-war movement on the left kind of dissipated when Obama became president, because then a lot more of them started just like making excuses and like
apologize. Today, I noticed with the left, the anti-war faction has really died down. Everything with the left is just that Trump's a racist, a xenophobe, a fascist, and a misogynist. But the left-wing criticism of his war stance has been fairly tepid, except for a few examples.
Well, that's true, but also, I would expect that to change now that Trump is actually engaging in this stuff. You'll see that kind of sentiment start to come back now that Trump is the one that is actually doing it. So I can see that. I think that the real question is just whether people are comfortable agreeing with people that they don't like on all these other issues. Yeah, like, I mean, I wrote an article promoting Tulsi Gabbard for president, pretty much just almost specifically on this issue, and she has come out against these Syrian strikes, and I mean, it doesn't even matter to me if you know, if she wants to the day before that she's tweeting about the wage gap and things like that, so it doesn't even matter to me. Like, those issues are minuscule in terms of like whoever is on the side of just getting us out of these conflicts, because the resources that are being used are just totally wasted. It's absolutely none of our business, and they just keep doing it. They can't stop themselves.
Anatoly, do you want to comment on that topic?
I actually did the video article, People Who Hate Each Other Against the War. It's a very interesting idea. I support this idea of some alt-right figure like Richard Spencer sharing a stage with Antifa or some SJW. Do you have any candidates?
Well, the problem with, I think, Antifa is that they don't really have as much of a public figurehead with any name recognition that I can think of. Offhand, I would think, you know, maybe it would have to be more of a pundit type personality, like I said, like somebody from the Young Turks, or like someone like a Tulsi Gabbard. I wouldn't expect natural.
Chapel Clubhouse.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't expect an actual politician, mm-hmm. though, to be willing to do it, because they're just risking too much. in terms of, you know, being on the same stage as someone like that is too damaging if you're an actual, like, public politician. But if you were, for someone who was a popular pundit.
The Congress, like, you might have, there's like a small handful of Republican congressmen who are against this. One of them, I think it was maybe Tulsi Gabbard and Republican Walter Jones, who's kind of a Buchananite. They sponsored a bill against arming the rebels in Syria. So you do see it to some degree in the Congress.
Yeah, I think that it would be interesting to see it from the perspective of people that have actually been kind of like fighting each other in the streets and things like that. But people that really, really hate each other. It kind of like almost like when people with like Tom Metzger would meet with like the Black Panthers and something like that. Like you need something like that would be on that level. I think it would be important. I think it also is kind of something that's been interesting, that it kind of it reunified a lot of the factions that a couple weeks ago were just nothing but drama and like infighting and all of that. Suddenly, like, those people kind of forgot about it. I almost wanted to make a joke about that maybe Trump authorized these strikes on Syria as a way to get people, you know, to distract from like the Ricky Vaughn doxing and all the drama and all
I don't think Trump really cares that much about the alt-right. I think he views them as like a minuscule powerless group.
Well, I think at this point it's clear that Trump doesn't even really understand like why people voted for him or the meaning of his own candidacy. Like that seems pretty clear to me that that he really has no idea that who his supporters even are and like what they want.
Because that was a key issue he won. A lot of people voted for Trump because they saw Hillary Clinton as starting World War III.
As a warmonger, yeah.
Yeah, as a warmonger and potentially starting World War III by intervening in Syria. And now Trump is doing exactly what they feared Hillary would have done.
Yeah, he's doing all of this. He's brought back all of this Bush era. He's like George W. Bush's fifth term or something right now. That's what like he's operating under. And all of these neocons and all that, like back during the campaign, he articulated something closer to like Buchanan or even like a Ralph Nader foreign policy. And now he's like...
Yeah, he was even against the war in Iraq when Bush was president. And then when Obama was president, in 2013, Trump put out a tweet that says, "Do not attack Syria." And a lot of people are retweeting that right now. Yeah, lots of tweets.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, we might have been suckered, looking back on it, because, as people, as leftists really were, and I have to give it to them, as they were pointing out, Trump's major complaint with Iraq wasn't really so much that that Bush invaded a southern country, but because he didn't take all the oil.
Oh, right.
There was that, but I remember the interview that he did back in 2004 with Greta Van Susteren, and when he said, "Look, we should never have been there. The weapons of mass destruction, like it was a total lie, we should never have been there." And even though he was kind of like, one of those, like, he was for it before he was against it, and so what. Like, I don't really hold that much against him from that long time ago, because, I mean, back when in that era, like, I supported the war, too. I mean, I was young, and, like, I believed a lot of that bullshit, but it's like, these other people, they clearly haven't, like, learned any lessons from that. And you still got the same old neocons that are doing this all, like, on behalf of Israel, that they're just goading us into this. You just look at the names, it's just all the same old neocons that are just pushing us into this. And whether or not we got suckered by Trump, I said it even when he was running, that like it didn't really matter, because he was the only candidate that was even attempting to articulate something against us getting involved in these things. So it's not like, well, yeah, we got suckered, but still the other people all wanted war too, so we had nothing but him to take a chance on. There was no other alternative.
Oh, I just want to point out though that one difference that Trump does have, possibly the major one from Hillary, is that he's going about all this in a much less competent way. So he's been like seeking a fight with China, with Russia, with Iran, with the Europeans over trade, and the Democrat would have been a bit cleverer about this, I think. But okay, carry on.
So back to what Anatoly was talking about earlier about possible scenarios. Another Unz essay was the road to World War III, and I don't. This is not necessarily a likely scenario, but just again like the worst case scenario. And you talk about things that could lead up to World War III. I don't think, and you do talk about what would happen if there was a nuclear exchange. I don't think that would happen because of mutual destruction. But what probably you also talk about China's role and whether China would intervene on Russia's behalf or just sit back and let Russia and the United States destroy each other and emerge as the world superpower.
Well, just to quickly recap, especially for Brandon, since he just joined us after we had this discussion. My basis thesis is that by committing to an attack back in 2017, Trump committed himself to a cycle of escalation and there are perverse incentives for the people who are doing these chemical attacks, assuming it's not Assad for some idiotic reason, to continue doing these because each new response, it has to be bigger and bigger than the one before, so logically there might come a time when this response will actually affect the Russian military presence in Syria. Now, Russia can't win in Syria because CENTCOM is much more powerful than the Russian forces at Khmeimim and Tartus. So Russia will have to, either it has to back down and lose face, which could be politically dangerous for Putin, or it could escalate, but in other regions, such as in the state of Hormuz, or in the Ukraine, or in the Baltics, the possibilities. So, it's not a prediction by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a range of scenarios of things that could go wrong and potentially escalate, and potentially yes, although the likelihood is very low, I agree with you. Nuclear war is not excluded. For instance, if Russia, like say, responds in the Baltics and conquers them, and then NATO is falling apart because say Germany decides that it doesn't want to die for Riga, then perhaps the Americans could initiate a nuclear exchange, or maybe the Russians could initiate a nuclear exchange if they're losing conventionally. So we're getting into this really dangerous territory, potentially.
So what's most likely scenario to happen is a kind of more of a Cold War scenario where, as you were mentioning, with more U.S. sanctions and possibly like small-scale proxy wars, so it's more likely to be like another return of the Cold War.
And generally speaking, I think so. Yes, because maybe Trump was serious about attempting to restore relations with Russia, but it's obvious that RussiaGate simply makes that impossible, and in fact pushes him into the other direction. In fact, to prove that he is not Putin's puppet, Trump has to continue escalating against Putin. Although you can never really prove to those people that Putin doesn't control him. It's just locked into the cycle of escalation. And just the other week, the United States increased sanctions on Russia even further. There's now discussions about what Russia can do in response to that. For instance, one recent proposal, which is being discussed in the Duma right now, is to stop recognizing U.S. patents in Russia, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. And presidents often start wars to avoid scandals. There's even a film about that called Wag the Dog, But Trump is doing, I think that's a major factor for intervention besides the factors I mentioned earlier. Trump is doing this to distract from the attacks from the liberals, but also from the neocons that he's a Russian puppet. But you also saw this with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton bombed Serbia right after the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Yes. Of course, it's much more difficult. I mean, you can bomb Serbia. Serbia, to be frank, it can't really do much, nor can Syria do much at the end of the day. But this is a bit of another matter. So playing these games with a nuclear superpower, it's a bit of a concerning situation.
So a major war obviously would weaken both countries dramatically. Do you think China would emerge as the world superpower then?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm assuming the conflict remains conventional, or even just assuming that there's like a new Iron Curtain that will gradually appear between Russia and the West. So I think, yes, I think Russia will continue drifting in China's camp. And there's some fantasies that people have that that China actually doesn't like Russia and that it will use the opportunity to seize Siberia, whatever. I think this is nonsense and it's basically fantasies. China has zero interest in seeing Russia getting regime changed by the U.S. or economically collapsing, because it doesn't have good relationships with Japan. Doesn't have good relationships with the U.S. Doesn't have good relationships with India. Russia is pretty much China's only large-scale strategic partner. Even Vietnam doesn't like China.
Saying there's tension.
Source of hydrocarbons. Because the Chinese Navy is still a lot weaker than the U.S. Navy, and the U.S. Navy could cut oil imports from the Middle East across the Strait of Malacca. So Russia would be the only alternative to that. So I think China and Russia will continue getting closer together.
So with China's surrounding countries, Japan's obviously a close U.S. ally. With India is not super friendly with China right now.
Yeah, although relations between India and Russia are actually good, but between India and China, they're thrusting. They've got territorial disputes.
Yeah, I think in Kashmir and maybe even parts of Tibet, another factor is the Chinese are building the Silk Road project, and that's going to encircle India, so they're building ports in Pakistan and Sri Lanka, and that will put a lot of pressure around India. And they'll feel under siege.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. So, I mean, it's also a source of concern, of course, that India and China they have this sort of competition between them, and China is much stronger than India. So, on the other hand, you might start seeing. Well, actually, we are seeing it already. India starting to come closer to the U.S.
What are your general thoughts on Putin's re-election, and did you vote for him?
So basically what happened is that after Crimea's reincorporation into Russia, it was very popular with Russians because both Russians and Crimeans have always regarded each other as Russians. So Crimea was actually transferred from Russia to the Ukraine in the 1950s, back in the Soviet Union, when this didn't make a difference. And so this had a huge effect on Putin's approval ratings. So he was a bit in the doldrums by the early 2010s. He was at around 60% approval ratings, no more. And there were protests against him, not huge ones, but substantial ones, back in 2011, 2012. After Crimea, his ratings skyrocketed to 80%, and they've remained around that position ever since. It's So yeah, the result that he got, 76.7%, I believe, it was genuine. There was actually considerably less electoral fraud than in previous elections, actually, which is why there were no major protests about it. So it reflects reality. Personally, I've been getting a bit less enthusiastic about Putin because of various issues. So one thing in particular, there's the equivalent of hate speech, European hate speech laws in Russia. It's Article 282. Before about 2015 or 2014, it was rarely used, but it seems to be increasing a lot.
So Putin, in a sense, even though he's an enemy of Trump, in a sense, they're similar in some regards, in the sense that he's this kind of quasi-civic nationalist?
Well, yes, he can be called a civic nationalist, yes. But what I don't like personally about these stands, especially Article 282, is that I sometimes write about these human biodiversity and so on, and potentially that could concern me if I write something that's very politically incorrect. So before 2015, 2016, it's not something that I'd have worried about because it was rarely, very rarely used. But it's getting used more and more frequently. And another issue, frankly, I think Putin is getting tired. He's been in power for 18 years, and he's starting to make more and more questionable economic decisions, for instance, and political decisions. There's a lot of pretty stupid bans, such as just the other day, for instance, they blocked Telegram, which is a sort of equivalent of something that combines WhatsApp and Twitter, basically. So I don't like these stands very much. I'm not very. I actually had a protest vote. I voted for Zhirinovsky.
Oh, Vladimir Zhirinovsky. He's a Russian nationalist.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want him as a president, but it's just a way of registering some discontent without being voting for a liberal who loves America and without voting for a communist. So the nationalist is the only avenue left to make that sort of protest vote.
I know there was one candidate who was like a total Hillary Clinton clone, like SJW. Then you had Navalny, who was the anti-corruption candidate. Interestingly enough, you were mentioning on a previous podcast that Navalny was critical of mass immigration from Central Asia. Is he a nationalist to some degree?
To some degree, yes. So, I mean, I would say that he's more of a populist. So the anti-Central Asian immigration is perhaps the one solid plank of his, part of his platform. But he's also not a nationalist in the sense that he is basically one of those very pro-Western nationalists, like this person who thinks that Russia should basically like take orders from the United States more or less. So he was against the Crimea, for instance, and he is also in contact with the Americans. He's suggesting people to sanction them, oligarchs. So, I mean, the oligarchs not very popular here, but if he's actually going to the United States and giving names of people who to sanction, I don't think that's an appropriate way for a politician to behave, not even speaking of a nationalist politician.
What candidate was the favorite of the oligarchs and the general ultra-wealthy people who live in central Moscow?
Even in central Moscow, most of them voted for Putin. I mean, fewer of them voted, so turnout was lower there than the national average, and that was because Navalny wasn't running in these elections. He was barred from standing, and so he called for a boycott of the election, which wasn't successful overall. Turnout actually increased relative to 2012, but turnout actually fell a bit in central Moscow.
This is slightly off topic, but Vladimir Zhirinovsky has an interesting theory that if Europe, Western Europe in particular, were to collapse due to the whole migrant situation, it would benefit the United States economically because all that investments from countries like Germany and France and the UK would go into the UK. I'm sure a lot of wealthy people would move to the West. So in the same way, that's basically what happened in World War II. Europe and Asia were destroyed, and the United States emerged as a superpower because of that in the 50s and post-war period. Do you think Zhirinovsky's theory on that, about the migrant crisis, has any validity?
Well, I mean, he's the sort of person who likes to make very very grandiose claims like this. I mean, just search on YouTube. So he's got all sorts of colorful dance in which he makes bold claims. So I wouldn't take it seriously. And I mean, I'm not even sure how that's supposed to work because Britain is also Islamizing very quickly.
Yeah, I know Zhirinovsky has some pretty grandiose ideas. Like, he advocates creating a new Byzantine Empire, which would include Israel and the Levant and Turkey.
I wouldn't pay attention to him. But I mean, I liked some of his platforms. So he said that he'd remove Article 282, which is the hate speech law, which I support. And he also said that he'll ease the process for ethnic Russians getting Russian citizenship. So right now we have this very bizarre situation in which it's actually easier for a Tajik or an Uzbek to get Russian citizenship than it is for a ethnic Russian from the Ukraine, for instance, and it's very bizarre and strange, and not really what you'd expect of a country that's supposedly ruled by the godfather of the alt-right, according to Hillary Clinton.
Brandon, were you going to say something?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, in a sense, Putin is similar to Trump in that he's portrayed. He has this reputation for all of these things, but if you look at the actual policies, it's not so much the case. You know, both his enemies and his supporters in the alt-right tend to project all of these things onto him, but really it's not all true. And they do the same thing with Trump, even though Putin is obviously a much more established and much more real political leader than Trump, who is just kind of a fluke. Also, I wanted to say that I think that the theory about Europe collapsing and it making the United States more prosperous, I don't think that it's really the case, because if that were to happen, like, people seem to forget that even though there's this migrant crisis in Europe, that demographically the migrant situation in America is really much worse. So, like, the U.S. is much deeper in the hole demographically than a country like Sweden, even though Sweden has this reputation of taking in all of these migrants.
Well, you've lived in both London and the SF Bay Area. How would you compare the immigration situation in California and the Bay Area to the situation in London, which has a huge Muslim population?
Well, I much prefer the SF Bay Area because, first of all, Latinos, they're just better people. So, I mean, I don't actually have anything against Latinos. I lived in a Latino-majority area for a year and a half. And, I mean, this will get me tossed out of the banks of the old type, but it's safe living there. Crime rates aren't any high amongst them. Maybe a bit higher, but if so, not by much. Not cardinally so. It's blacks and other big problem in that respect, but not so much Latinos. It does seem to me that Latinos are an America which, not that I support the process, but an America which starts becoming more Latino, it's still going to remain a country that's recognizably American to a very considerable extent. And you can't really say the same with respect to the black and Muslim immigrants, which predominate amongst the European countries, even though so far they're much smaller percentage of the population.
Well, Ron Unz has pointed this out, and Ron Unz lives in the Bay Area. He was saying that cities in the Bay Area with high crime rates like Richmond and Oakland are primarily because of African Americans. Well, San Jose, which is mostly Hispanic and Asian, which is the future demographics of the country, is a very safe city.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would disagree living in Phoenix because the Mexican community is like responsible for almost all of the crime. There's not even very many blacks here at all. And that's where you have all of the robberies and cars breaking into. And I think that I don't like to use the term Latino or Hispanic because I think that it groupifies people together that aren't necessarily the same or have a lot in common. Like someone who is, you could tell the difference, at least living here for a long time, between like a European, like a Spaniard or something from Cuba or Argentina or Paraguay or one of these countries, than somebody who looks like an Aztec or something. It's just culturally, they're just completely different, even like within the city of Phoenix. I find that, there's an awful lot of crime that's associated with them, in like robbery, theft, and that kind of thing. I don't know, you know, maybe it's not as bad as Muslim migrants, but keep in mind that the U.S. is a big place. So if you're in the Bay Area, or if you're just in one part, you might say, well, you know, these people aren't that much of a problem. But if you go to like Minneapolis, well, there you have tons of like people from the Somali community and all of these other groups that are in different parts of the country, because they're not all migrating to the same areas, so that maybe in where I live you don't see as much of that. But to be honest, in my neighborhood has a large Middle Eastern and Indian like component to it. The mall where I grew up in is like most of the chain stores have closed down, and they're all of like these Indian stores selling these rugs and whatnot, you know, where like American Eagle Outfitters and like Abercrombie used to be. It's now like some kind of Indian store selling like rugs and jars, and the food court is all like Middle Eastern food, and so it's really not, it's not just that they're coming from Mexico and these other countries. Like they're coming from all over here, and so demographically, like the U.S., I think is much worse off. I don't even recognize really the city that I grew up in. It's, unless you go to certain pockets, like of areas that are suburban and haven't really been hit by it that much. But all of the major high schools and things like that in Phoenix, they're all predominantly like third world. But I don't like the term Hispanic so much because it puts people that really have nothing in common and don't even like each other in same the same boat.
The U.S. Census also has separate categories for white Hispanics and non-white Hispanics, right?
Oh, that's true.
Many Hispanics are basically white and they identify as white. And this is another component to the crime. If you ever wanted to have a few laughs and look something up, there, Whenever people talk about how, oh, Hispanic crime isn't that high, and it's mostly it's red herring. Like Ron Unz had brought that up a lot. But if you actually go through, if you took some time and you went through some mugshot websites, right, and you looked at the mugshots of all the Hispanic, it says that it labels them as white. So it makes you wonder, like, how much of these, like, how much is the white number of criminal activity, the percentage, how much is that actually being inflated by categorizing all of these other these illegal immigrants and things as white?
This is a good point. I mean, are there any benefits to labeling like Hispanic non-white immigrants as whites?
I think there's something which naturally happens, is that people, they get identified that way just if they start to think that that they have privilege and all of this other kind of stuff. If they get hit by charges of being white, then they'll be part of the backlash to that. I think a lot of it happens naturally. Mm-hmm. You know, because my girlfriend, her family is from Spain, and when she was in high school, even though she could speak Spanish, like, she got bullied by, like, the Mexican girls, because they obviously saw her as white, even though she could speak Spanish, because she had white skin, and so I think that there is some benefit to it, in the sense that even when they called somebody like George Zimmerman white, well, and suddenly then he discovered that he was, like, had new allies on the other side.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be part of the backlash. Uh-huh. Yeah. You know,
it's
what I
all
mean?
Conditional or, to what situation you're in.
Yeah, or even some of these younger people, like the younger Jews that maybe look white, you say, like, there used to always be the joke, like, oh, you know, hey, fellow white people with Jews, because they would always, like, use that to kind of promote white guilt and all this stuff. But I think you're also seeing some of these, like, younger Jews that have grown up being suddenly, like, fallen for that, being told they have privilege and all that stuff, and that they really do think they're white.
Or I even see that
white,
one trend,
and
I've noticed
there's, like, a backlash.
Is it used to be that the multiculturalist left was very sensitive to Jewish issues, but I've been noticing a change where I've heard SJWs that support Hillary Clinton dismissing Bernie Sanders as just an old white guy.
Right, and so, like, it's kind of like that old joke, hey, fellow white people. Well, now even some of these younger Jews, like, even they that have gotten suckered by that, and they're, like, apologizing for their white privilege, you know, and things like that, and they're actually being part of the backlash to that, saying, like, well, screw that, you know, you call me privileged, I don't care. They've even fallen for their own, like, their own propaganda.
I was reading statistics that said 100,000 white people left the San Francisco Bay Area since the year 2000. When you were living there, Anatoly, did you notice that decline, and was that part of the reason, the demographic changes, why you left?
Oh, no. I mean, I was planning to leave for Russia eventually anyway, so that didn't really play any role. But this phenomenon definitely exists. There's a lot of qualified native white people, Californians, who are leaving after graduation because, I think the main reason is that in California the housing prices are ridiculous. I think that's pretty well known. So if you get a good education, like a in pharmacological science or something, and move to Colorado, I think is very popular nowadays, or it was when back in the mid 2010s anyway. You could just go there and slash your, like, housing prices by a factor of three and get almost the same salary. No wonder people are doing that. So yeah, and by the way, one other thing that I want to note about London is that I really developed an appreciation for the American police state, because they really do keep crime rates low. So in London, burglary is basically out of control. There's even been cases where people, well, blacks mostly, they'd approach somebody who's sitting in a cafe or something and splash some acid in his face and grab his cell phone and run away.
What about Russia? How's that been like for since you've been back in terms of crime? I always think of it as being kind of dangerous in some of the bigger cities in Russia. Has that been your experience, or do they have kind of under control?
Oh no, it's actually the way down. It's Moscow is the safest city, and it's been improving very rapidly. So there was a huge crime spike in the 1990s after the Soviet collapse. But it's been going down ever since 2000 or so, and nowadays Moscow is actually very safe. I've been here for a year and a half now. I haven't experienced any significant crime personally. Well, I mean, I've heard of crimes, but haven't experienced them myself. When I was staying in London with my dad just a couple of months ago, I had my cell phone stolen, which is why I'm much more enthusiastic about locking people up nowadays.
Back to Trump, a big reason people were supporting Trump was because of his immigration policies, and I was reading this report that said that the RAISE Act, which Trump was supporting, would reduce the status where whites would become a minority by about it would reverse it by 5 years, but the chance of that bill is passing in the Senate is very slim. Trump can't even get the wall built, and now it looks like the Democrats are going to win the Congress, so he has a Democratic Congress combined with some Paul Ryan type Republicans, so he's going to accomplish very little on those issues. And then he's going to be very vulnerable in 2020, and we could end up with someone like Kamala Harris. Anatoly, you wrote about this in your Black Pill scenario essay, and also your Alt-Right is Dead essay.
So, I mean, this has always been a problem, and we sort of deluded ourselves about Trump's genius 4D chess strategies and so on, but it's time to admit that he's not very intelligent, and he's basically been totally outmaneuvered by very intelligent Jews like Schumer. He's just not even in the same league as them. So even though he's got the presidency, he's got both houses, and he's got the judiciary, he can't get anything done.
It's like he's putting out these wall prototypes, like. And before it was it's ridiculous.
He doesn't even have that kind of time, really. I think Trump is finished at this point because he's alienated his base to the point that they're going to get wiped out in the midterms, and then that's just going to amp up all of the impeachment stuff and just the anti-Trump sentiment in the Congress, and it's just going to amp it up. But he's no longer going to have these tough, like, social media promoters and defenders, like those people, even like people like Cernovich, you know, like even those people are I mean, they're through with Trump after the Syria thing. So those were a lot of the people that helped push him over the top in the election. Like, he's not going to have those kind of people backing him for re-election, I don't think, at least with the same kind of intensity. If it gets into a situation where they're just like saying, well, he's the lesser of two evils, I really don't think that that's not going to motivate people enough to the extent that we're people as enthusiastic as they were. He only won by like a paper thin margin the first time, so like without that enthusiasm, like, he's screwed. Yeah. Like, he's toast.
Yeah, there's going to be five million more Latinos by the next elections, and much less enthusiasm. So Paul was worshipping him as the God Emperor of mankind in 2016. Nowadays, nobody cares about him anymore. You mentioned Cernovic. There's also Ann Coulter. She's been like really anti-Trump for half a year now, if not more.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Anatoly Karlin and also Brandon Adamson for being on.
Oh, thanks, guys.
All right, thank you. It was a pleasure, as always.